about it for a second. I mean, enlightenment is the change that changes everything, right? You've actually awakened, you've blown your mind, as it were, right? You've moved beyond at least the kind of obsession of all of the contractions that create, you know, so much brutality in the world. Well,
yeah.
If that's true, I mean, if this product is, let me phrase it in crass terms, if this product is so good, why aren't people buying, right? In other words, do we need a better marketing firm? I mean, do we need better branding? Do we need more lists? I mean, you know, this is like the great elixir, right, you know, of the perennial philosophy of all the great traditions. So why is it singularly uninteresting, right, to the masses, certainly of the West and of the westernizing world? And so the Enlightenment teachers generally say, which is all true, what they say is true but partial, well, the ego, the traps of the ego, you know, and it's, you know, hard to die to the separate self, you know, all the correct answers, but they're insufficient. They're
right.
Insufficient. People aren't, and what they fail to point out is that people have an intuitive sense that actually I exist uniquely.
Right.
That I actually am a unique expression, a feature of the seamless code of the universe. And the way enlightenment is taught to them, right, is that basically you have to deny that intuition, and that intuition is a function of ego. And the masses of healthy, what Cook called, mystic philosopher Cook called Ruach HaHamoniha Atzili, the healthy spiritual intuition of the masses. It's a great phrase, right? Basically said, actually, no, I'm actually not giving up my uniqueness. That's part of the core function of my dignity, and they didn't have a move to make. And so for the first time, this world spirituality based on integral principles, emergent of unique self, makes enlightenment, you know, what William James would call, I guess, a genuine option, right, for the world, you know, for the masses of people, and that changes the game. There's no exaggeration, there's no hyperbole, you know, there's no marketing, it actually changes the game. You can actually begin to talk about enlightenment, right, in a way which speaks to, right, the correct spiritual intuition, which both wants to move beyond the contraction and wants to affirm uniqueness. And once you get this distinction between states and structure stages, and then between separateness and uniqueness, which is built on the first distinction, right, you literally open up the single most important possibly human understanding, you know, revelation, fruit of the eye of the spirit, which heretofore has been blocked. So that's, I mean, Ken, I can't think of anything more exciting at this moment.
Yeah, and I mean, part of the difficulty is that we said earlier that the sort of the common, one of the common tenets of the world's traditions is that there are two selves. And there is a subtle distinction, and it's a hard distinction to keep operative. It's a hard distinction to keep in practice. And that is the actual distinction between the small self, the separate self, the self-contraction, and the big self, the true self, the unique self. And this is, you can see this in things like Ramana Maharshi using the phrase I-I.
Mm-hmm.
So the one I, the first I, is the small self. And so when we tell anybody now, just, you know, be aware of yourself. Just right now, just notice yourself. Be aware of yourself. Now, when you do that, notice that there are actually two selves. There's the self you're aware of, but you can see, you're this, you're that, you feel this way, you feel that way, you're so tall, you weigh so much, you do this job, da 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 da. And there's the observing self. Now, the observing self is the true self, is the real self, is the self that you're trying to get in touch with. But unfortunately, what you constantly do is you transfer that observing self and its essence to your small, finite, individual, itty-bitty self. And that is the fundamental confusion of non-enlightenment.
Right.
And yet, yes, in a sense, they're close because, you know, they're both awareness, and if you just sort of casually look within and don't use discriminating awareness, then you're not going to tease them apart. But to notice I is to be ensconced in the I that is the true self that has a perspective on the small self and everything else that's arising. So distinguishing those can be tough. In some cases, it's, you know, it's easier to just toss it and not follow through on that. But it's also to deny the unique or even in some sense the personal plus components of the real self is self-contradictory, because one of the ways that the real self in many traditions is known is by the simple, unchanging experience of I am-ness. Now, that I am-ness is a very deep I am-ness. It's not I am this or I am that. It's just pure I am-ness. And that pure I am-ness is the one unchanging experience that every person has. You can't remember what you were doing probably 2 weeks ago at this time. But one thing you know was there was the sense of I am-ness. And it was an unchanging sense, the same I am-ness you have right now. And so when people are asked to deny that any part of I am-ness is part of enlightenment, they're asked to deny that part of the real self that shows up as I am-ness. And they know better than that. And they're being asked to give up something that is the only constant experience in their life.
Right.
The experience that goes all the way back to when they were born, as a matter of fact, all the way back to before when they were born, before Abraham was, I am. And that I am-ness is simply another name for God. It's another name for the true, i.e. unique, self. And it was there prior to the Big Bang. It would be there after the end of the universe, because it doesn't enter the stream of time. It is literally the unborn and the undying. But it's there for anybody who wants to know it. You aware of I am-ness? Welcome home. Welcome to God. Welcome to Spirit. Coming along and saying, oh, now, deny that. That's not real. And that just won't work. You can't deny Spirit.
Right.
So what you can deny is the part of I am-ness that is I am this or I am that.
Right.
That's the separate self. That's the self-contraction. That's what you want to transcend. But you can't gut it all, because the fundamental isness of I am-ness is Spirit.
Right.
And you cannot deny Spirit without contradiction, for reasons that everybody from Shankara to Descartes has pointed out. And so once you set off down that path, attempting to deny I am-ness, then it's an endless contradictory adventure, and simply confuses the issue enormously, whereas realizing that becoming more and more in touch with the very core of I am-ness is becoming more and more in touch with the core of the unique self, which is one with the divine. It at least isn't self-contradictory and impossible.
Which is a step in the right direction.
Step in the right direction.
Right. I mean, basically, there's two denials. I mean, if we kind of frame it that way, there's two denials that both, you know, which both are propagated with enormous force in the world, and both run counter to reality or to realness, as it were, and therefore, you know, both kind of run into a brick wall. One is the denial of spirit, the denial of depth, the denial of I am-ness, of true self, which is the kind of Western materialistic kind of reduction view that, you know, took hold so strongly. And someone like Freud, who was still intoxicated with this view, you know, did you know, in Hebrew that you'd say shminiot ba'avir, meaning he did kind of incredible calisthenic intellectual distortions in order to account for it, right?
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, explain it. And when you look at it, you're kind of, really? So that's one denial. But the other denial, right, is the denial that exists in the mystical traditions, whether it's, you know, a moment in Hasidism, you know, or it's a moment in, you know, Mahayana, you know, which is, you know, not fully integrating its own truths on both sides of it, because you have texts that are more fully integrative of its own implicit truths and texts that aren't, which is denial of uniqueness, right? It's denial of individuality, but not individuality at the level of separate self or the contraction or the distortion, but individuality at the level of, you know, your unique perspective, which is an irreducible feature of essence, right? And both of those denials, right, produce, right, enormous confusion, right, in, you know, each of them in one huge swath of humanity. And that confusion results in incredible pain, you know, and incredible, you know, from pain, of course, you know, comes fear, and from fear comes violence, and the entire cycle of samsara. And so the introduction of unique self, again, we're not talking about a casual series of dialogues that Wilbur and Goffney did, and we're not talking about integral spiritual experience. So we found a nice topic, and aren't we glad we did with our friend Sean Hargens, you know, a great, you know, volume on, you know, unique self, right? But we're and it's, you know, it's not about a couple of academic books. It's about actually a shift, you know, emergent from world spirituality, integral principles, emergent from integral spiritual center, a shift in the very source code, right, of understanding an evolution of our understanding of reality, an evolution, you know, of enlightenment itself. And that's the excitement. And maybe to add one more piece to our 101 and turn it back to you, Mega K, which is, you know, the personal and the impersonal, which we've flirted with, you know, in a number of, you know, comments, you know, today. But I want to try and explicate it and then turn it over to you, because the second confusion, right, that you see in the literature, both ancient, you know, modern and postmodern, is the confusion between, you know, or the confusion in relationship to the personal. And if I could maybe frame it like this. In virtually all writing, and I say this not casually, but, you know, with, you know, kind of not with my teacher self, but with my scholar self, you know, with a lot of authority, you know, in virtually all writing, there's just a complete conflation of the word personal with personality, separate self, you know, ego. And when I say ego, I don't mean it in the healthy Kernberg, you know, Otto Kernberg integrating principle sense, but, you know, ego as, you know, separate self, personality, you know, contraction. The personal is just identified, you know, and stuck there. And again, in a recent book I read, there were, you know, I counted, there were 137 references to the personal. Every single one of them, right, dismissed the personal without exception. And in that same book, every single one of them conflated separateness and uniqueness, every one of them. I mean, it was just a shocking, you know, example of this contemporary mistake. When actually, if you step back, you actually realize the following, that there's actually two, you know, if you will, grand archetypes. You know, there's kind of, there's the personal and the impersonal. There's personal man and impersonal man, if I can use that kind of Sprungian, you know, German typology. But actually, there are only two out of three, minimally, if we would kind of map it. So I would say kind of level one is the personal of the personality. Level one is the personal, you know, which is all the stuff that, you know, the shock of, you know, Gurdjieff's shock of separation, you know, entry into this world, the fixation of attention, you know, the styles that we develop to cope with the pain of samsara, the distortions which result, right, that notion of personality and the kind of, you know, incidental proclivities and flavors, you know, of personality in all of their, you know, poignancy and all of their frailty and all of their ephemeral nature, that's personal personality level one. You need to move beyond that to transcend that, to end the trance of personal / personality and realize this I am-ness, this true self, the true nature of all that is, right, and the true nature of yourself. And that's impersonal. You know, and you referred to it earlier, Ken, as impersonal. That's impersonal. That's just not, it's not personal in the sense of, you know, level one personal. But what then happens is your true self awakens as unique self, and unique self is ultimately personal, right? It's the personal phase of essence, which is your unique expression, right, of essence, which is by definition inexorably personal. And so personal reappears, right, at this level three. You refer to it, I talk about these three stages. You refer to it, I think, in early writing as personal plus and personal minus.
Right.
One of the places that we met in the early days And when you look at personhood in this sense, right, you begin to kind of reclaim the personal and you disambiguate this enormous confusion. And again, it's not intellectual confusion. It's somatic, emotional, mind confusion in the mind of all the people, you know, which is most of the world, studying some version of this distortion. And the ability to reclaim the personal at a higher level of consciousness and to not fall into this level one, level three, or what you call pre-trans, essentially, it's a version of that fallacy, right, is enormously important because if I would get off the call and I would say, hey, I spoke to Ken today and, you know, he was kind of impersonal, right? I wouldn't be saying, wow, wasn't that great? Right? He was realized in his, you know, non-dual expression of, you know, Nirvana Kalpa Samadhi, right, but hadn't gotten to Sahaj, right? No, I'd be saying, Jesus, you know, I really love Ken, but, you know, man, I guess, you know, was he not feeling well? Did he not like me today? Why was he impersonal? And if I would get off the call and say, wow, I just felt like Ken's personal, like, warmth, I wouldn't be saying, well, you know, Ken was in his personality today. You know, he was stuck in his personal warmth. No, I'd be saying, no, wow, I felt the personal quality of essence, right, expressed and refracted, you know, in the intersubjective space between Ken and myself. And I was delighted by that, not because of grasping personality, but because personal essence met personal essence. So the ability to reclaim the personal at a higher level of consciousness is just another critical, unique self 101 movement, right, to disambiguate the confusion, right, and change the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that indeed is why I started talking about personal plus, because there was such a confusion. The worst source of the confusion, frankly, coming from Theravadan Buddhism, which has been a disaster, and got rid of the problem basically altogether by its doctrine of anatta, which says that it's absolutely true that no entity has a self of any sort at all. And so when you find Nagarjuna, essentially the founder of Mahayana Buddhism, what he attacks is not Hinduism, which you would think is a good Buddhist he would attack. He spends most of his time attacking Theravadans.
Right.
And he says, look, this thing is really screwed up. We look at it in terms of the two truths. In relative truth, a separate self in a healthy, cohut fashion is necessary. And it's as real, relatively real, as moment-to-moment dharmas are. So subject and object arise together and are equally real, relatively real, and are part of the relative realm. And so to say that anatta applies to the relative realm is simply wrong. So now, does anatta apply to the absolute realm? And in that, you can't say, and this is where people don't quite get all the way over the hump, It's true you can't say that in the absolute emptiness, in the strictest technical sense, cannot be described as self or having self. But nor can it be said not to have self. These are both two dualistic concepts. And absolute reality is neither self nor not self, nor both nor neither. So is anatta absolutely true? No, it's false. So in both relative and absolute truths, the Theravada notion of anatta is false. And so that has just screwed up, particularly in the West, the attempt to understand everything from self and its relation to enlightenment and the notion of personal and its relation to enlightenment or any of those states. Of course, the ultimate confusion goes back to not understanding structures and states. And so as Mahayana continued to grow and evolve, slowly, as a metaphoric use of language, the word self in one form or another was moved back in to reality. And so Zen talks about a true self. The Nirvana Sutra talks about the Maha Atman, the great self. And that's in essence what we're talking about. As in the unmanifest realm, the true self. And then as soon as there's a manifestation at all, that true self immediately is a unique self, depending on the personality in the person in which it is housed.
Right.
And that's a person plus, not a person minus.
That's the personal level.
When the unique self shows up, it doesn't suck the person out. It adds absolute reality to that perspective that that person has.
Yeah, and which changes the entire game. I remember in our very, very, very first meeting, we're talking about that maybe 2002 or 3, I don't even remember, but we were looking at an article. I had read two of your books, and at that stage, and I think it was a local person in Boulder, a friend of yours, had sent you the Tikkun article on levels of prophets and pagans, or something of that nature, where my levels of consciousness article, and that was our first conversation. And I remember in the conversation we met in this thing about the personal. This distinction is so important, and it's so lost, and it's so confusing to people. I mean, what do you do, right? If you're desperately seeking to come home, you're seeking whatever you want to call it, God, enlightenment, essence. And you have your experience of yourself in the world is personal, and then you're told that in some sense that's wrong, right? In other words, you're supposed to be impersonal, but you can't find yourself in the impersonal until you awaken to it as true self, and then you awaken as I am and say, wow, but then you've got this other personal thing that's equally real, right? It's real. It's not abstract, and you're kind of told, no, you're kind of lost there, right? That's at the egoic level, and the failure to make that distinction just creates a confusion that's enormous, and it's rooted partially, I think, in Theravada, right? That's one major root, and I've said this to you a number of times, and I want to say it in public now. One of my most enjoyable footnote in sex ecology and spirituality was your long, it must be a 20-page footnote about
So footnote 1 to chapter 14. I hate on that footnote than anything.
I hate when you know your books better than I do. It always annoys me. it's an awesome. Awesome, awesome footnote. And I want to point to a second place where this impersonal issue gets confused, because one location is the denial, of personal in that ancient Theravadan place, and that's the place where it occurs in the lineage traditions and the mystical traditions. But there's a second place which we might call a kind of Hegelian and then translated into a kind of Marxist-Leninist versions of evolutionary spirituality. Obviously, evolutionary spirituality has important and wonderful positive expressions. That's a given, and, key friends of ours are engaged in it in many different ways, and obviously Aurobindo, had this, huge contribution in Deshardin and, et cetera, et cetera. That's a given. Having said that, granting that beautiful given, and you and I have talked with our colleague Andrew about the proto-evolutionary moment in Kabbalah, which is core to my native tradition, which is all evolutionary, not evolution of the biosphere, but the sense that spirit is evolving and you're always creating something new and et cetera. So all that's beautiful. And for everyone who listened to that quick sentence, we're just kind of deep bowed to the evolutionary moment. Evolution is. That's a given. But here's the weakness. The shadow is, along comes Hegel, talking about the emergence of absolute spirit unfolding, historically in the way he used the word historical, which you can spend about, 50 years trying to figure out on a bad day. But basically, the problem is that the process effaces the personal. And the way that it's taught, I don't think this was Hegel's intention. And then when I was 20, 21, I had my Hegel you know, period of time, and that's when I met, you know, Charles Taylor's, you know, awesome work, you know, in that Hegelian sphere. Now, I'm not sure what Hegel's intention was, but it's very, very clear that the way he was translated in the 20th century, you know, both by the Marxist-Leninists, you know, and by, you know, the National Socialists, you know, a.k.a. the Nazis, you know, what was a legitimate read of Hegel was that actually the process reigns, right? The process and what you can do to serve the process, that's great. But actually the process is the one true reality. And what that does is, of course, is rob, right, you know, consciousness of one of its great evolutions, which is the evolution into understanding, you know, the grow-up understanding of the dignity and ultimately the infinite dignity, right, of the individual, right? And it defaces the personal. And what we're trying to say here in Unique Self is that actually, right, the impersonal expression of enlightenment that lives in Theravada or that lives in, let's say, an awakened Hegel, that is beautiful, but then you have to kind of move beyond it, right, to the personal face of the process, right, to the unique expression of the process, which is irreducible and therefore has irreducible dignity. And this was the correct contribution, right, of the liberal world, right? In other words, its shadow was, you know, the narcissistic hyperinflation, right, of the personal before emptiness, of the personal of separate self. But the correct intuition of kind of the best world of, you know, Matthew Arnold and Thomas Carlyle and all the great, you know, Western thinkers, you know, but which really expresses itself powerfully, you know, in awakened Western mystics, right, is this sense of the personal after the impersonal. And it's not really after, of course. What we mean after is a wrong word because it's more of a linear word. It's in the depth of the impersonal, right, is perspective. And the depth of the impersonal is the personal face of essence. And actually, right, you awaken as unique self, right, as the unique expression, right, of, you know, the evolutionary imperative. You know, Aurobindo's evolutionary imperative lives uniquely in you, and that's the source of your unique creativity. And so we desperately need to reclaim, you know, the personal on the other side of the impersonal, right, in order to clarify both our own internal experience, right, and to actually ameliorate the pain caused by the inappropriate confusion between, let me go back to your terms, between personal minus and personal plus.
Well, it's the only way that evolution can occur beyond the merely biological. And the problem is that, of course, biological evolution occurs, and it, in my opinion, can't quite occur the way the neo-Darwinian synthesis thinks it can, because there are just still too many little bitty problems with the notion of just mutation and random natural selection. That's just not enough to get us from dirt to Shakespeare. First of all, there's a force in the universe that is the opposite of randomness, and a lot of people like Stuart Kaufman and so on have speculated that force is self-organization, and Eric Jantz thought that, and so did many traditional philosophers that would identify it with something like Eros, which is a drive towards higher and higher unions. And so you take something like the immune system that has so many parts to it that could not possibly have evolved by checking each part out with natural selection, because the thing only works as a whole, and yet you're never going to get enough mutations happening all at once to produce that massive leap into an immune system. So there's a force that is driving evolution, and certainly mutation and natural selection is a part of it, but so is Eros, or love, or creativity, or whatever you want to call it, is built into the cosmos. And so once we move beyond biological evolution, and which as almost everybody has acknowledged, biological evolution, when it comes to something like the brain, has stopped. I mean, it stopped about 50,000 years ago. And yet, if you look at, let's say, culture,
right,
and cultural evolution, well, how on earth is that happening?
Right.
Well, the force of that is personal choice. It has that individual personal choice in all four quadrants introduces options into the cosmos that get laid down as cosmic grooves and are passed on not through genes. And now that we've got the genome done and have been alarmed to find how few genes there are, that we know that everything that arises just cannot be governed by mere genes. It's just enormously insufficient number of genes to account for, well, hardly anything. So it's a whole conscious choice occurring in persons. And that's the mechanism by which evolution continues. And if you look at the speed of evolution in cultural unfolding and development and evolution, it's staggering. I mean, we've gone from structures archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic in a mere 10,000 years, which is in biological and physiological evolutionary time is nothing, and yet it is huge in terms of the changes and the cosmic habits and the natural habits, which of course Peirce referred to as laws, that have been brought into existence through personal. And the whole point about making evolution and having the evolution not just of the fittest, but the evolution of the wisest is that the person develops more and more depth. That is to say, the unique self increasingly becomes the chooser of options that get laid down as evolutionary grooves. And so the more the unique self is in charge of evolution, the better off we all are. And so that's not a small issue to bring up.
That is not a small issue.
Awesome. You know?
That's awesome. I mean, it's not, right, I mean, it's not a small issue. I mean, it's the largest issue. And basically what you see is these two trajectories that are actually completely parallel to each other that until this unique self-conversation pretty much went unnoticed. So one trajectory is the deepening of the personal. Right? I mean, there's a doctor by, what's his name, Peter Abs, that talks about when the word self came into the dictionary, you know, in the Renaissance.
Yeah.
So in the Renaissance, there's a losing of, you know, although the Renaissance is still has a deep sense of true self in a lot of ways. It's pre, you know, it's still, you know, 150, 200 years earlier. But there's this enormous deepening of the personal. There's this emergence of the personal. And I've told you before, my favorite book of yours is Up from Eden.
Yeah.
That's my utterly favorite book, and, you know, in long conversations, I've described it to you as an evangelical book in the best sense, you know, carrying the good news. And one of the things that it, you know, charts so beautifully, right, is the emergence of the personal, you know, first at the separate self level, you know,
yeah.
in other words, and afterwards, you know, moving into transcendence. So there's this evolution of the personal, which is quickening all the time, and then there's the second trajectory, which is the quickening of cultural evolution, post-biological of cultural evolution, which is quickening literally all the time. In other words, you know, in the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, the pace is incredible. And you look at people like Ray Kurzweil, and you look at, you know, what it might be in the next 25, 30 years, it's almost shocking. So what used to take billions of years and then a couple of million years is happening, you know, now, I mean, in our lifetime, we're seeing massive seismic changes. So there's these two trajectories that are actually speeding up right at the same time, and it's not a coincidence. Actually, one is directly informing and animating, you know, the other. And it's the increase of the personal and the deepening of the personal, right, actually completely shifts
right, and accelerates, right, and evolves, right, evolution itself, in which case the conclusion we're drawing is that the essential engine of evolution is unique self.
Yeah, absolutely. And because that's certainly at the leading edge, and the leading edge is the, in a sense, the only place where there's room for genuinely new cosmic habits to be laid down. We go back and we look at something like red or magic or amber or mythic. Those are structures that have been repeated so many times that I say they're like the Grand Canyon. They're just so deep that if it rains, water's going to run all the way down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and end up flowing along the river at the bottom. It's not going to stay halfway up the side of the Grand Canyon or on top. It's going to continue to cut deeper and deeper and deeper, but it goes without saying that that's where the water's going. It's going to follow that groove. It's going to follow that extraordinary cut in the Earth's surface. And yet right next to it, if we are wanting to start where the leading edge of evolution is now, which is somewhere around turquoise or somewhere around Centauric or vision logic or whatever term one wants, that's a group that's about, 2 or 3 feet deep. And not like, a mile deep like Grand Canyon. And so that's just being cut. And it's the leading edge that can do the cutting, because somebody who's down at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, say red, can't cut a new groove up on top. They are, in a sense, simply going to have to follow what's already there. And so it's the leading edge, the frothy, chaotic leading edge of evolution in all four quadrants, where new things get laid down, where new cosmic habits or laws start to come into being. And so, of course, it's the leading edge that's doing that. And the leadingest edge is the unique self, and is being laid down by individuals who have deeply realized I am-ness and the uniqueness of their realization of that right. I am-ness.
Right. And that's why leading edge people are so distinguishable, right? They're not, you can't mistake them, right?
Right.
They're very, and they arouse enormous, sometimes adulation and opposition because of their distinctness. That's just because they're by definition, infinitely personal, right? And not personal in the separate self sense, although,
right.
They may have all their quirks on that level, other than, of course, you and me who have completely worked them out, but I'm talking about everybody else, right? But they're just infinitely personal, and it's that personal creativity that is the engine of evolution, which sometimes it's interesting, Ken. I've noticed this in a couple of thinkers who are heavily influenced by the Enlightenment traditions in a really positive way, but are kind of lost in the impersonal thing. So what they'll do is they'll unconsciously affirm choice. Right? And as the move they'll make is, well, but choice is central, right? Not realizing that actually choice is personal. That's exactly the point, right? The notion that there's a kind of a window of choice beyond determinism is precisely what we mean by the personal. And actually, choice is in some sense, right, a synonym of the personal, because choice is not an expression of the impersonal process. It's an expression of the personal essence of the impersonal process, which is choosing, right, which is, affirming, that personal nature. And so that actually brings, into the conversation perhaps the last piece of 101. And after we finish this last piece of 101, we'll decide, do we want to then go to the change that changes everything or take a break till next week? But, but it's so important, the 101, and you'll tell me where you are when we finish 101, we want to go on or do a part two. But let's bring up this personal notion, which is really the notion of you, of the personal expression of the intelligence of the cosmos. So,
yeah.
So you talked about eros, you know, love, creativity, but whatever name we're going to talk about, evolutionary eros, and actually, as you know, we reproduced and edited and added some stuff to a core dialogue we did at the beginning of the Future of Love Dialogues, which was awesome, you know, about this evolutionary love, which is an appendix in the Unique Self book, but it's this notion of intelligence. So let me try and bring it, you know, in a kind of roundabout way. You know, people ask about prayer. You know, so I was actually sitting not that long ago with our colleague, John Wellwood, you know, about, you know, I don't know, 8 months ago. And, you know, he basically said to me, like, you know, Gaffney, you know, I know Mariana for a long time. Mariana, the awesome mother of Zion, and him are good friends. And, you know, we met through him. And he said, you know, I've read some of your stuff. You know, gave me a couple of, you know, compliments that, you know, lovely, you know, only your mother believes. Thank you, John. But he says, but how could you believe in prayer? Right? And the point was, like, how could an intelligent human being, right, possibly, right, you know, talk about prayer, right, really? So, you know, I said, well, what do you believe in? I mean, what's your thing? Well, you know, awareness. Well, why are you so sure about awareness? Well, because that's a realization, you know, John says correctly, you know, and John's brilliant. You know, that's a realization. So his assumption was that prayer must be a dogma, you know? And so I said to him, well, prayer is also a realization. Prayer is an awakening, right, to, right, the second face of the divine. And that, you know, that story that I shared with you almost a decade ago, it's that awesome story of this non-dual realizer. And Edel really looks at him as one of the key non-dual realizers in his hermeneutic book, on Kabbalah, you know, where he basically, you know, Levi Isaac of Berditchev, you know, starts to make a blessing. And so he says, Baruch atah Adonai, blessed are you. And there's a long text after that, but he can never get there because he goes, blessed are you, and he faints in ecstasy, right? He can't get beyond you, right? Now, he's not fainting in ecstasy because of a dogma, right? He's fainting in ecstasy because he's realizing, he's having a realization, a felt first-person experience of the second-person personal intelligence, right, of the cosmos, and he's having that realization that Rumi had when Rumi, you know, awoke in that second-person face of being held, of every place you fall into, you know, God's hands, not God in the mythic membership sense, but, right, but the awake personal intelligence, right, that, you know, is sitting in that seat next to you, as it were, all of the third person in that second person incarnation, right, and holding you, which doesn't mean that that second person isn't also awake in you as Tattvamasi, as far as that. So I am lives in paradoxical creativity with being held, right, by the divine, and, you know, and paradox always is the deepest revelation of reality. And so what unique self, right, really brings to the table is that uniqueness always implies relationship, right? And it's without uniqueness, right, if you're only in oneness, so there's not relationship because it just is, right? But the second you realize perspective, right, that you create conversation. Perspective creates dialogue, right? Perspective means there's relationship. And so the second I realize, right, and I awaken as unique self, and I awaken as the personal phase of essence living in me and through me, right, then relationship to, right, a personal intelligence, which is not a mythic God, it's not an ethnocentric homophobic God, right, it's not a limited, right, it's the awakened unique self of the cosmos, as it were, that includes all unique selves and holds me at the same time, and prayer becomes not a mythic expression, but prayer is kind of reclaimed, if you will, an integral prayer, if you will, you know, at a second tier of consciousness becomes an awakened living possibility again. And so that's the last piece of 101 of unique self. It brings the personal on board, right, at this higher level of consciousness, which in turn, right, brings the personal face of divinity, which lives paradoxically with the impersonal face of divinity, right? They're both two faces, right, of the one. And so that's the last 101 piece I wanted to put out there and turn back to you.
Yeah, it's in a sense there's two types of prayers, and both of them are fine, but one of them is more open to egoic abuse, shall we say. But there's petitionary prayer and there's contemplative prayer. And petitionary prayer is, dear God, please give me the new job. And it was classically made fun of by the Janis Joplin, "Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends." and on and on and on. And there, that's not an elevated use of the I-thou relationship. But the other contemplative prayer has several different forms, but it's essentially the heartfelt awakening of I am-ness, and then expressing and finding divine love and divine happiness and divine joy and expressing gratitude and all of these sort of higher emotions that you can do when you assume the second phase of spirit and you take up an I-thou relationship. And person is just being plus intelligence. The entire fucking universe is a being with intelligence.
I mean,
that's what second person spirit is. And so I don't see how you can deny being plus intelligence. And so it's just resonating with that form of spirit. And there's of course that's not a dogma. That's a realization.
Right.
And the great thing about prayer is that unlike just worshiping third person face a spirit, and let's say you know marveling at the Grand Canyon and having that type of nature wonder and experience, and unlike mindfulness or first person meditation, ego can hide out in both of those. First and third person are easy places for ego to hide out,
mm-hmm.
because there's just nothing really fundamentally challenging it. But with second person, you're fundamentally supplicating that which you recognize in some sense transcends your own separateness and your own separate self. And there's no place to hide out.
Right.
And when you are truly consenting to the presence of the Lord, when you are truly throwing yourself wide open to spirit, then there's no place to hide. And so it's a very powerful form of practice. And everybody's spiritual practice should be some mixture of first, second, and third person. And this is certainly true of second person.
Yeah, yeah. No, so you completely receive. So unique self implies second person. And so it implies second person both in terms of relationship. So, for example, we talk about in the book the seven laws of unique self-encounter. So what's an evolutionary unique self-encounter? Because there's a particular quality of relationship, which is when true/emergent unique self meet each other, right? And, right, it's second person, you know, all the way up, all the way down, as it were, right?
Yeah.
The other is there, right, at every level of consciousness. And so the personal face of the being plus, plus intelligence, right, is the personhood, right, of the universe. It's the personhood,
yeah,
of the cosmos. It's the quality of personal, which is a quality of the cosmos, which is not about the contracted and distorted separate self personality, but for which, as you say, you bow and surrender. And paradoxically, Ken, even Eastern traditions, you know, which didn't have a formal doctrinal sense of the personal and actually dismissed the personal, still had a lot of prostrations, right? In other words, you know, it's paradoxical that there was this, you have this sense of surrendering, which although might have, you know, appeared, you know, in fundamentalist garb, but the intuition of surrender, right, to the personal, you know, was always there.
Second person Yeah. It was a powerful realization.
Powerful realization. And the movement from dogma to realization just changes the game. You know, it's like we just identify prayer or second person with the mythic arresting of that realization at a particular level of consciousness, and we need to liberate, you know, the second person from that limiting, you know, cultural space, you know, of amber, you know, and
that's
huge. I want to just push the envelope a little more in something that we actually haven't, you know, we've never discussed before. So I want to push the Mercedes-Benz thing for a second. You know, so now first off, I would ask for a Lexus. I want to just kind of start there. Right? You know, Mercedes-Benz, you know, these guys, you know, they were making those death machines, you know, and my mother, she would look at a Mercedes-Benz, you know, you grew up in an Orthodox Jewish household, and, I mean, she would spit. I mean, she was just so,
well,
you know, devastated.
Don't take Bayer aspirin, man.
You don't have Bayer aspirin, you're dead and Bayer. I mean, there's a lot of things you can't do.
Yeah.
So blessings on that, and you know, and the infinite, you know, crazy pain of that, and you know, so I wouldn't ask for a Mercedes. I want to kind of first grant that point, but I want to talk about, you know, asking for personal need for a second, and I want to kind of invite bringing back online, right, a second form of petitionary prayer, which is not kind of its degraded form, you know, and its degraded form, you know, as you know, has two expressions. One is God, give me the Mercedes-Benz in that popular song. And the other is kind of the cheapened form of like that secret movie, which is, you know, manifest with your intention, your new car. You know, and so there's the new age, you know, kind of affirmative prayer, cheapened version of petitionary prayer. They're actually mirrors of each other, you know, which one is through kind of your first person, God can manifest your car. And the other is your second person, God can manifest your car. You know, but both of them are rooted in a kind of degradation, right, of a kind of, you know, profound intuition. And so there is also the realization that prayer in some sense affirms the dignity of personal need, right? And, you know, the Baal Shem Tov had an expression, and translating it loosely from the Yiddish, which was ask for everything, right? Ask for everything. And what he meant was not that you're caught up in the kind of narcissistic, you know, personality self, but that actually, you know, human need has infinite value and dignity, and that when you actually turn to, you know, source, right, and you ask, which in some sense is a self-conversation, right, you're asking, right, the higher self of the unique divine that lives in you, as you, and through you, and you're also at the same time, as all of spirit lives in you, right, it's also no less true that there's a cosmic being intelligence that's personal, awake, alive, and pulsating, which is the process that's described in the evolutionary, you know, kind of notion. And so when you begin to understand that that process is alive, personal, pulsating, intelligent, even as it's far beyond, you know, and not only far beyond, via negativa, you can't even talk about it in the same sentence as the narrow level one personal, then actually turning and invoking, right, the personal face of that quality of intelligence for the sake of my son's health, you know, for the sake of, you know, being able to live my unique self in the world, you know, for the sake of, you know, having enough funding for Center for World Spirituality, you know, having enough funding to, you know, for the Integral Institute, you know, whatever it is, you know, there's a way to do that which is not a degraded form, but it's a surrendered form of saying, you know, Spirit, you know, move through me, you know, manifest in the ways that you can. And I'm invoking you, which is me and beyond me in that paradoxical panentheistic moment, you know, and so we can reclaim, I think, petitionary prayer in its non-degraded form, what we might call an evolved form of petitionary prayer. So I want to offer that into the conversation.
Sure. It's like homicide. I mean, it all comes down to motivation. And if one's motivation is, you know, is fairly clean and fairly pure and benefits others as well as oneself, although of course for oneself is fine, again, as long as it's not, you know, give me the strength to wipe out that person kind of thing. Depending on motivation, then I, you know, it's totally fine. You don't want to just you know, do nothing but petitionary prayer, because that implies that the only self that you're aware of is the small self, and that's rather what you're looking to get over. But not only is that kind of petitionary prayer okay, there's a lot of really spooky evidence that it can have really rather remarkable effects on an individual's health. For example, there are studies of people with heart disease and prayer, and those who get prayed for survive in higher percentages than those who don't.
Right.
And so, give me some of that.
Give me some of that.
Yeah.
I remember actually our first meeting we prayed together. That was I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, just came in. Yeah, yeah, no, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, no, total. So blessings, you know, blessings on prayer in its evolved form and being able to reclaim. And, you know, in some sense, I remember having a discussion with our colleague who I don't know well. I had just, you know, two or three conversations with. I know you've done a number of deep dialogues with Cynthia Bergeau.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to describe her the sense of divinity that emerges from this unique self-realization, and I described it spontaneously in a discussion with her as the infinity of intimacy. You know,
uh-huh.
You know, and that, you know, the infinity of intimacy. So when you're intimate with someone, you care about them,
right?
Right? I mean, that's what it means. You know, intimacy means, you know, intimacy arouses caring. Right? It's not just functional, and it's not just, you know, a utilitarian partnership, and it's not just a cognitive appreciation of their dignity and value. Right, it's this deep felt sense of, you know, caring and concern. And whenever you describe the move from ego to ethno to world to cosmocentric, you describe it always so beautifully as a movement of a felt sense of expanded caring and concern.
Right.
So you might describe it as, you know, this movement in consciousness to these higher moral states as an evolution of intimacy.
Right.
It's an expansion of intimacy. And so when source and the awake process, which is intelligent, is realized as the infinity of intimacy, so then a natural turning towards, right, in prayer, right, becomes a natural expression, right, which when coupled with, you know, a broader prayer in an evolutionary context for the evolution of the cosmos, right, for hungry children, right, whenever you're praying only about yourself, you know you're in trouble, right? Yeah. Something's gone wrong there.
Yeah.
Wow. So,